A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about nicotinic receptors in the brain, and specifically about bupropion, the antidepressant that also helps people quit smoking. The naming is the first thing that trips people up. These are called nicotinic receptors because nicotine happens to activate them, but they evolve for a completely different molecule, acetylcholine, and they're busy doing their job whether anyone's ever touched a cigarette or not. So the question is, what do these receptors actually do, and how does a drug like bupropion hijack that system?
The naming thing is genuinely one of the worst accidents in pharmacology. Imagine if we discovered the dopamine receptor because someone noticed cocaine binds to it, and then for the next 100 years we called it the cocaine receptor. That's basically what happened. Nicotine was isolated in the early 1800s, and by the early 1900s, physiologists had noticed that nicotine mimics the effects of stimulating certain nerves. So they named the receptor after the drug, not the endogenous ligand. The endogenous ligand, acetylcholine, wasn't even identified until the 1920s.
The cocaine receptor of the parasympathetic nervous system.
Right. And then it gets worse because there's a whole parallel naming system. Acetylcholine actually binds to two completely different families of receptors. The ones we're talking about, nicotinic, but also muscarinic receptors, named after muscarine from certain mushrooms. Same endogenous neurotransmitter, acetylcholine, but two entirely different receptor architectures. Nicotinic receptors are ion channels. Muscarinic receptors are GPCRs, G-protein-coupled receptors. Totally different signaling mechanisms, same activating molecule.
Acetylcholine shows up, and depending on which receptor it meets, it either opens a pore or kicks off a second messenger cascade. That's like a key that opens two completely different types of lock.
And the nicotinic receptors. Let me just nail down the structure because it matters for everything we're going to talk about. They're pentameric, 5 protein subunits arranged in a ring around a central pore. When acetylcholine binds, the pore opens and sodium and calcium ions rush in. Direct, fast, no second messenger. We're talking ion flux within microseconds of binding.
But not all the same, right? That's where the complexity comes in.
That's the whole game. There are alpha subunits, alpha 2 through alpha 10, and beta subunits, beta 2 through beta 4. Different combinations produce receptors with different locations, different kinetics, different pharmacology. The most abundant subtype in the brain is alpha 4 beta 2, which is 2 alpha 4 subunits and 3 beta 2 subunits arranged around that pore. That's the one nicotine loves most, and it's everywhere in the cortex and hippocampus.
When we say nicotinic receptor, we're not talking about one thing. We're talking about a family of related, but functionally distinct ion channels that happen to share a binding site architecture.
The binding site itself is fascinating. In the alpha 4 beta 2 receptor, there's a binding pocket at the interface between an alpha and a beta subunit. The key structural motif is a tyrosine tryptophan, tyrosine sequence, 3 aromatic amino acids that form what's called an aromatic box. The quaternary ammonium group of acetylcholine, that positively charged nitrogen, slots into this box and is stabilized by what are called cation-pi interactions. It's not a covalent bond, it's the electron clouds of those aromatic rings interacting with the positive charge.
Acetylcholine docks into this aromatic box. The pore opens, ions flow, signal propagates. That's the normal physiology. Nicotine does the same thing but hangs around longer.
Acetylcholine is cleared from the synapse within milliseconds by acetylcholinesterase, the enzyme that breaks it down. Nicotine isn't a substrate for acetylcholinesterase. It binds, activates, and then just, the residence time on alpha 4 beta 2 is dramatically longer. That's one reason nicotine is so reinforcing. It produces sustained activation rather than a brief pulse.
Which brings us to desensitization. You mentioned earlier that these receptors don't just stay open.
This is critical. Within milliseconds to seconds of sustained agonist exposure, the receptor enters a desensitized state. The pore closes even though the ligand is still bound. The receptor is effectively offline. This is a huge part of nicotine pharmacology. When someone smokes repeatedly, a significant fraction of their nicotinic receptors are in this desensitized state, occupied but non-functional. During sleep or abstinence, some fraction recovers, and the sudden return of functional receptors contributes to craving and withdrawal.
Withdrawal isn't just the absence of nicotine. It's receptors waking up and screaming for input.
That's the emerging view. And it explains something that confused researchers for years, why nicotine can act as both a stimulant and a depressant depending on dose and timing. Low doses activate, high sustained doses desensitize and effectively block transmission.
Let's pull back for a second. Where are these receptors actually located, and what are they doing in a non-smoker?
Three major domains. First, the neuromuscular junction, that's the muscle-type nicotinic receptor, different subunit composition, alpha-1, beta-1, delta-epsilon, or gamma. That's how your motor neurons tell your muscles to contract. Second, autonomic ganglia, both sympathetic and parasympathetic, where nicotinic receptors mediate the fast transmission between preganglionic and postganglionic neurons. Third, the central nervous system, and this is where it gets rich.
In the CNS, it's not just about direct excitation.
No, and this is a major misconception. A lot of nicotinic receptors in the brain are located presynaptically, not postsynaptically. They sit on the axon terminals of other neurons and modulate the release of other neurotransmitters. So, a nicotinic receptor on a dopaminergic terminal in the nucleus accumbens. When activated, it enhances dopamine release. On a glutamatergic terminal, it enhances glutamate release. On a GABAergic terminal, it enhances GABA release. They're gain controllers, not just on-off switches.
The volume knob on a mixing board, not the power button.
This presynaptic role is why nicotinic receptors influence so many different systems. Cognition, attention, reward, anxiety, pain perception. They're distributed in the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex, the ventral tegmental area, the thalamus. The alpha-7 subtype, which is homomeric, 5 alpha-7 subunits, is especially interesting. It has very fast kinetics, desensitizes almost instantly, and has unusually high calcium permeability. It's implicated in sensory gating, the brain's ability to filter out irrelevant stimuli.
That's the thing that goes wrong in schizophrenia, right? The inability to filter?
Patients with schizophrenia often show deficits in what's called P50 auditory gating. If you play two clicks in quick succession, a normal brain suppresses the response to the second click. Schizophrenia patients often don't. And that deficit correlates with reduced alpha-7 nicotinic receptor function. This is why alpha-7 agonists have been in clinical trials for schizophrenia. The connection is actually striking, and it's part of why people with schizophrenia smoke at rates of around 70-80%, way above the general population. They may be self-medicating a sensory gating deficit.
They've discovered, through trial and error, that nicotine patches a broken filter.
And that brings us to the clinical side of this whole puzzle. If we could target specific nicotinic receptor subtypes, alpha-7 for sensory gating, alpha-4 beta-2 for cognitive enhancement, alpha-3 beta-4 for addiction, we'd have a whole pharmacopoeia. The problem has been selectivity and side effects at the muscle and ganglionic receptors.
Which is the perfect segue to bupropion. He's a drug that was developed as an antidepressant, a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, and then someone noticed that depressed patients taking it were spontaneously quitting smoking.
The story is one of the great serendipitous discoveries in psychopharmacology. In 1994, a clinical trial was running for bupropion as an antidepressant. The investigator started getting reports from patients. "I don't feel like smoking anymore. Cigarettes taste different. I just stopped." This wasn't the primary endpoint, nobody was looking for it. But the signal was strong enough that they ran dedicated smoking cessation trials, and in 1997 the FDI approved bupropion for smoking cessation under the brand name Zyban.
Same molecule as Wellbutrin, different brand, different indication.
Exactly the same drug, 150 milligrams twice daily. And here's where the mechanism gets interesting, and where it connects to everything we've been saying about nicotinic receptors. Bupropion is an NDRI. It blocks the reuptake of norepinephrine and dopamine, which is how it treats depression. But its effect on smoking cessation has nothing to do with dopamine reuptake. It's a non-competitive antagonist at nicotinic receptors, specifically the alpha-3 beta-2 and alpha-4 beta-2 subtypes.
It's doing two completely separate things at the same time. Reuptake inhibition for mood, receptor blockade for smoking.
Those two mechanisms are pharmacologically independent. You can block one without the other, at least in theory. The nicotinic antagonism occurs at clinically relevant concentrations, the IC50. The concentration that inhibits 50% of receptor activity is around 1 to 2 micromolar for alpha-3 beta-2. That's within the plasma concentration range achieved by the standard 150 mg twice daily dose.
Let me make sure I understand the logic. If nicotine activates nicotinic receptors to produce reward, and bupropion blocks those same receptors, then a smoker taking bupropion should get less reward from smoking. The cigarette becomes less satisfying. But that also means less withdrawal when they stop, because the receptors are already partially occupied by an antagonist.
That's the dual mechanism, reduced reward and reduced withdrawal. And it's different from nicotine replacement therapy, which gives you nicotine through a patch or gum. That approach maintains receptor activation through a safer delivery route, tapering down over time. Bupropion says, no, we're going to block the receptor so nicotine can't do its thing, and we're going to do it before you even quit.
It's pre-treatment, essentially. You start bupropion a week or two before the quit date, while still smoking, and by the time you stop, the receptors are already occupied by the antagonist.
That's the protocol. Start bupropion, set a quit date for day 7 to 14 of treatment, and by that point the drug has reached steady state and the receptors are partially blocked. The cigarette stop being rewarding, or at least less rewarding, and the quit attempt is more likely to succeed.
What do the numbers actually look like?
Meta-analyses show bupropion roughly doubles quit rates versus placebo at 6 months. We're talking about 19% sustained abstinence with bupropion versus around 9% with placebo. That's meaningful but modest. It's not a magic bullet. Varenicline, which we should talk about, does better. Varenicline shows quit rates around 26 to 27% at 6 months in comparable trials.
Bupropion is the middle tier. Better than nothing. Better than placebo. Not as effective as varenicline. But it's got a different side effect profile. And it's an antidepressant, which matters for the significant fraction of smokers who have comorbid depression.
That's exactly the clinical calculus. If you have a patient with depression who smokes, bupropion can address both problems with one drug. If you have a patient without depression who's failed nicotine replacement, varenicline is probably the next step, and the mechanisms are completely different, which is worth spelling out. Varenicline is a partial agonist at alpha-4 beta-2 nicotinic receptors. It binds to the same site as nicotine and acetylcholine, activates the receptor weakly, and crucially, prevents nicotine from binding. So it provides a low level of receptor activation, enough to reduce craving and withdrawal, while blocking the full rewarding spike from inhaled nicotine. Bupropion, by contrast, is an antagonist. It doesn't activate the receptor at all. It just occupies the site and prevents activation by anything else.
Varenicline is like a dimmer switch set to 5%. There's some light, but you can't crank it up. And bupropion is a circuit breaker. The light's just off.
Varenicline has about a 3.5-fold higher affinity for alpha-4 beta-2 than nicotine itself. It's basically outcompeting nicotine for the binding site. That's why it works so well, but it's also why it can cause vivid dreams and, in rare cases, neuropsychiatric side effects. You're messing with a receptor system that's widespread in the brain.
The side effect profile of bupropion is different. Seizure risk is the big one, right?
Dose-dependent seizure risk, which is why the maximum single dose is 150 milligrams, and the maximum daily dose for the immediate release formulation is 450 milligrams, though the sustained release used for smoking cessation is typically 300 milligrams total daily. The seizure risk at 300 milligrams is about 1 in 1,000, which is roughly comparable to other antidepressants. At higher doses, it climbs.
Bupropion is also a weird drug in that it doesn't cause the sexual side effects that SSRIs are notorious for, which matters for adherence.
Because it's not serotonergic. No serotonin reuptake inhibition at all. It's purely norepinephrine and dopamine. So no sexual dysfunction, no weight gain. If anything, a slight weight loss in some patients. For a lot of people, that side effect profile is preferable to SSRIs, independent of the smoking indication.
To summarize the bupropion story, a drug designed for depression turns out to be a nicotinic antagonist, gets rebranded as a smoking cessation aid, and the two mechanisms are completely separable. The antidepressant effect is reuptake inhibition. The anti-smoking effect is receptor blockade. Same pill, two different jobs.
It's a reminder that drugs are messy. We talk about clean versus dirty, drugs and pharmacology. Bupropion is dirty in the best sense. It hits multiple targets, and one of those off-target effects turned out to be clinically invaluable. If bupropion had been a perfectly selective dopamine reuptake inhibitor, it never would have helped anyone quit smoking.
Which raises the broader question, how many other drugs have useful off-target effects we haven't noticed yet, because nobody was looking?
That's the argument for systematic phenotypic screening, and it's something the field is circling back to after decades of target-based drug discovery. But let me circle back to something we touched on earlier that I think deserves more attention, the desensitization kinetics, because they explain something that puzzles a lot of people. People wonder why nicotine is addictive when it's a stimulant, but smoking also relaxes people. How can the same drug be both a stimulant and a relaxant? The answer is in the desensitization. When you take a drag on a cigarette, nicotine hits the brain within 7 to 10 seconds. That initial hit activates nicotinic receptors, particularly on dopaminergic neurons in the ventral tegmental area, causing a burst of dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens. That's the stimulant-rewarding effect. But within seconds to minutes, the receptors desensitize. The pore closes. The excitatory drive drops. And for someone who's been smoking all day, many of their receptors are already desensitized, so the net effect of additional nicotine can actually be a reduction in neuronal excitability as more receptors get locked into the desensitized state.
The relaxant effect is basically receptor fatigue.
Desensitization-induced quiescence. The receptors are present but functionally silent, and this is why the first cigarette of the day is the most satisfying. Overnight, a significant fraction of desensitized receptors have recovered. They're available to be activated again. That first hit produces the biggest dopamine spike, and it feels different from every cigarette that follows.
Which also explains why bupropion can work if you start it before the quit date. If the receptors are already occupied by an antagonist, that first cigarette of the day doesn't produce the same spike. The whole ritual becomes less rewarding before you even try to stop.
The clinical trials bear this out. Patients who start bupropion before quitting, rather than on the quit date itself, have higher abstinence rates. The pretreatment period matters.
Let's talk about the endogenous role again, because I think we've spent a lot of time on nicotine and bupropion, but the question asked about what these receptors normally do with acetylcholine.
In the non-smoking brain, acetylcholine is released from cholinergic neurons originating primarily in the basal forebrain and the pedunculopontine tegmental nucleus. The basal forebrain cholinergic system projects widely to the cortex and hippocampus. It's intimately involved in attention, learning, and memory. When you're in a state of focused attention, really concentrating on something, cholinergic tone in the cortex increases. Acetylcholine is being released, activating both nicotinic and muscarinic receptors.
The nicotinic component specifically.
Nicotinic receptors, particularly alpha-4, beta-2, and alpha-7 subtypes in the hippocampus, are involved in long-term potentiation, the cellular basis of memory formation. They enhance glutamate release from presynaptic terminals, which strengthen synaptic connections. There's also evidence that nicotinic receptors on inhibitory interneurons can shape network oscillations, particularly theta and gamma rhythms, which are associated with attention and memory encoding.
The endogenous system is doing exactly what nicotine hijacks, modulating attention, memory, and reward, but in a precisely regulated, temporally controlled way. Acetylcholine is released in pulses, does its thing, and is cleared almost instantly. Nicotine shows up and parks itself in the binding site for hours.
The concentration dynamics are completely different. Endogenous acetylcholine reaches local concentrations in the high micromolar range at the synapse, but it's gone within milliseconds. Nicotine from a cigarette produces plasma concentrations in the nanomolar range, much lower, but it's sustained. It's a low, constant tone rather than a sharp pulse. The receptor system didn't evolve for that kind of signal.
It's the difference between a conversation and someone leaning on the doorbell for 6 hours.
That's a very corny way to put it. and the receptor responds accordingly. It desensitizes, it internalizes, and over the longer term, chronic nicotine exposure actually upregulates nicotinic receptor number. Smokers have more nicotinic receptors in their brains than non-smokers, which seems paradoxical until you realize that most of those receptors are in a desensitized, non-functional state. The brain is compensating for the constant presence of the agonist by making more receptors but keeping them offline.
The brain adapts to the doorbell leaner by installing more doorbells and then disconnecting them.
That's actually not a bad analogy for receptor upregulation with desensitization. And when someone quits smoking, those upregulated receptors gradually recover function over weeks to months. The time course of receptor normalization tracks fairly well with the time course of craving and withdrawal symptoms. It takes about 6 to 12 weeks for receptor levels to return to baseline.
Which brings us back to bupropion. If it's an antagonist, does it cause receptor upregulation too? Or does it do the opposite?
Antagonists typically cause receptor upregulation without desensitization. The receptors are being blocked, so the cell compensates by making more of them, but they're not being activated, so they don't desensitize. With bupropion specifically, the data is less clear because it's not a pure antagonist, and it's usually studied in the context of smoking cessation, where the system is already dysregulated by chronic nicotine exposure. But in principle, a pure nicotinic antagonist would upregulate receptors while keeping them in a closed but activatable state.
That's relevant for what happens after someone stops taking bupropion. If you've been on it for 12 weeks and you stop, do those upregulated receptors suddenly become available for endogenous acetylcholine? Is there a discontinuation effect?
And the honest answer is that the clinical data on bupropion discontinuation doesn't show a dramatic withdrawal syndrome the way you see with nicotine or SSRIs. But the receptor level dynamics haven't been studied as thoroughly as you'd want. Most of the focus has been on whether people stay quit after stopping bupropion, not on what happens to their cholinergic signaling.
There's a research gap. What about the new drugs? You mentioned alpha-7 agonists for schizophrenia, alpha-4 beta-2 partial agonists for cognitive enhancement. Where does that stand?
The landscape is mixed. Alpha-7 positive allosteric modulators, drugs that enhance the receptor's response to acetylcholine without activating it directly, have been in phase 2 trials for schizophrenia and Alzheimer's disease. The idea is that you preserve the temporal and spatial pattern of endogenous acetylcholine signaling, but you amplify it. It's a more physiological approach than a direct agonist. Some of these have shown improvements in cognitive measures, but none have made it to market yet.
The Alzheimer's angle?
The cholinergic hypothesis of Alzheimer's has been around for decades. It's the basis for the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors like donepezil, which boost acetylcholine levels by blocking its breakdown. Those drugs help symptomatically, but don't modify disease progression. The nicotinic receptor angle is more specific. Alpha-7 receptors are particularly abundant in brain regions affected early in Alzheimer's, and they're involved in the cognitive processes that deteriorate. The hope is that a selective alpha-7 modulator could improve cognition without the peripheral side effects of boosting acetylcholine everywhere.
The trials have been disappointing so far.
Some showed signal, some didn't. The field is still working out the right patient population, the right dosing, the right outcome measures. It's not a dead end, but it's not a breakthrough either.
Which is basically where we are with most neuropsychiatric drug development. Incremental progress, no home runs.
The brain doesn't give up home runs easily. But the nicotinic system is worth pursuing because it's so broadly involved in cognition, attention, and reward. Even modest improvements in receptor subtype selectivity could open up new treatments for addiction, schizophrenia, ADHD, and cognitive decline. The bupropion story is a reminder that sometimes the most useful drugs are the ones that were designed for something else entirely.
To pull all of this together, the nicotinic receptor is a misnamed but fundamental component of cholinergic signaling. It's a pentameric ion channel that normally responds to acetylcholine with fast, direct excitation, modulating everything from muscle contraction to attention and reward. Nicotine hijacks it because it fits the binding pocket and isn't cleared by acetylcholinesterase. Bupropion docks it, which is why a drug designed for depression helps people quit smoking. and the next generation of subtype selective drugs might treat schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, or ADHD by fine-tuning specific receptor populations rather than flooding the whole system.
That's the arc, and the naming thing really does matter beyond pedantry. When we call it the nicotinic receptor, we implicitly center nicotine, the drug, rather than acetylcholine, the endogenous signaling molecule that's been using these receptors for hundreds of millions of years. It shapes how medical students think about the system, how patients understand their treatment, and even how drug discovery programs frame their targets.
The linguistic equivalent of putting the cart before the horse, and then naming the horse after the cart.
Then, being surprised when people assume the horse evolved to pull carts.
What should a clinician take from all this? If they're seeing a patient who smokes and has depression, bupropion is an obvious first-line option. If the patient doesn't have depression but has failed nicotine replacement, varenicline is probably the better bet, but bupropion is still a reasonable second-line choice. And the key thing to communicate to patients is that bupropion isn't replacing nicotine. It's blocking nicotine's target, so that smoking becomes less rewarding. It's pre-treatment, not substitution.
For patients who can't tolerate varenicline, the dreams, the nausea, the rare neuropsychiatric effects, bupropion offers a completely different mechanism with a different side effect profile. It's not just a weaker version of the same thing. It's a different thing.
Which is something that gets lost in the way we talk about smoking cessation aids. We rank them by quit rates. Varenicline beats bupropion, beats NRT, beats placebo. And that's useful, but it obscures the mechanistic diversity. Different drugs for different brains.
The comorbidity question is huge. Smoking rates are 2 to 3 times higher in people with depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia than in the general population. For those patients, treating the psychiatric condition and the nicotine addiction simultaneously, potentially with the same medication, changes the calculus.
The open question, and I think this is where we should leave it, is whether the nicotinic receptor system can be targeted for things beyond smoking cessation and schizophrenia. Cognitive enhancement in healthy people, neuroprotection after injury, maybe even modulating inflammation. Alpha-7 nicotinic receptors are expressed on immune cells and seem to play a role in the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway.
The vagus nerve releases acetylcholine onto immune cells in the spleen, activating alpha-7 nicotinic receptors, which suppresses pro-inflammatory cytokine production. It's called the cholinergic anti-inflammatory reflex, and it's being explored as a target for conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and sepsis. So nicotinic receptors aren't just in the brain and at the neuromuscular junction. They're part of how the nervous system regulates immunity.
Which means the naming problem is even worse than we thought. The nicotinic receptor is also an immune modulator. Calling it nicotinic makes it sound like a smoking thing, when it's actually a nervous system thing, an immune thing, a muscle thing, and a cognition thing. The name captures about 2% of what it actually does.
At this point, after a century of literature using the term, we're stuck with it. The best we can do is remind people that the name is a historical accident and that the receptor's real job, its evolutionary job, has nothing to do with tobacco.
A receptor by any other name would smell as, well, maybe not sweet, but it would certainly be less misleading.
That's the episode, really. Nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, not actually about nicotine, structurally elegant, clinically important, and responsible for one of the great serendipitous discoveries in psychopharmacology. Bupropion, the antidepressant that accidentally blocks nicotine's target and helps millions of people quit smoking.
Any forward-looking thought before we wrap?
I'm watching the alpha-4 beta-2 partial agonists in phase 2 for ADHD. If those pan out, we could see a non-stimulant ADHD medication that works through the cholinergic system, completely different mechanism from methylphenidate or amphetamine. That would be novel.
A cholinergic ADHD drug. The naming committee will probably call it the nicotine receptor pill and confuse everyone all over again. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In early medieval Nepal, the craftsman who built the Changu Narayan Temple used a specific fired clay floor tiling that, when later analyzed, turned out to be an aperiodic monotile, a single shape that can cover a floor completely without ever repeating its pattern. They had discovered the Einstein tile 1,200 years before mathematicians proved one could exist, and they probably had no idea they'd done it
They invented the Einstein tile while trying to build a temple floor.
The geometry of unintended consequences.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for that. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.